Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Paleoclimatologist Kurt Steger has studied 65 million years of Earth change and environment. That qualifies as the long view. Now he's throwing his eye forward, just a little in his terms, 100,000 years, to ask what's coming in heat and cold, furnace age and ice age, and how much may, jarringly, rest in our hands right now, in our little lifetimes. This hour on Point, we're looking way out into the climate waves of the deep future and our potential impact there. You can join the conversation. Do you think we'll be around 50, 100,000 years from now? Can your mind stretch that far, care that far? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Toronto, Canada, is paleoclimatologist Kurt Steger. He's an ecologist and paleoclimatologist at Paul Smith's College in upstate New York, has written extensively on climate change. Listeners to North Country Public Radio will know him from the weekly Natural Selection show. His new book is Deep Future, the Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Kurt Steger, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks.
What is a paleontologist like you doing stomping around in the future? I thought the past would be your thing.
Well, it usually keeps us pretty busy. We like looking at the big picture in time. And there was a new wave of climate prediction and climate modeling of the future that's been coming out in the scientific literature in recent years. And when I saw it, I thought, this is just amazing to be looking that far ahead. And it just sort of came naturally to a climate historian to think on those timescales. So I've been sort of knocking around in that future and trying to see what's out there.
Kurt, now your specialty, you write, is collecting layered core samples from the bottom of lakes and bogs in the Adirondacks and Peru and all over Africa. You pick out microscopic organisms that lived and died once there and reconstruct past climates from the patterns of change they show. So that means you've seen lots of heat and lots of cold, ice age and the opposite. What does that leave you thinking? I know that you were once a climate change skeptic. Are you one of these people then who believes there's nothing new under the sun or not?
Well, there's definitely something new under the sun, and that's us. And what I'm trying to do here is sort of let people know that while the general public at large has sort of been log jammed on this idea of is global warming happening and are we causing it and stuff, the scientific community's still been at work and has been exploring. And basically what made me, you could say, a climate skeptic originally was just being a good scientist. When someone like me talks about major climate change, we're talking about ice ages engulfing half of North America and things like that. And there certainly are natural cycles that a lot of climate deniers point out. And until relatively recently, it was maybe difficult to tell if the warming we have now is just part of one of those cycles. But the science is in now, and we can definitively show that those natural cycles have pretty much leveled off in recent decades. The temperature's still going up, and the only other real climate-changing factor is our greenhouse gas emissions, and that's got to be us.
You say it's time to move on from unproductive, politicized arguments you write over global warming to the next stage of inquiry. And as you just said, Kurt, you say the new thing in this whole picture is us, so much so that you and others who look over great expanses of time are sort of rolling out a new age, perhaps a new name for the epoch we're living in, not the kind of Pleistocene or Paleocene or any of those old scenes, but something new. What's up with that, Kurt?
That's really great. I mean, that should just show you right there that in the scientific community, the issue of human impacts on the world is just a fact of life now. And so there's a new name. It's in the mainstream of science, and it's coming out into the general public. It translates to the age of humans, like you think the age of dinosaurs or the age of mammals. Well, with our impacts not only on climate but on species extinctions and all other aspects of the world, the technical term now for the geological age we're in is the Anthropocene, or the age of humans.
Anthropocene, meaning that the world being primarily shaped, dominant, or shaped, I guess, by this one species, us?
Well, it's incredible. I mean, our numbers are so large, our technology is so powerful, that when we work and do one thing over and over again, for example, producing the waste gases, the greenhouse gases, just like any other species would, but with our numbers, we have become a geological force of nature. And so basically that's the theme of the book, is saying, well, we can look in the past. We've had natural changes before. But adding us to the equation opens up a whole new range of ethical and other questions.
So begin to walk us into that. The 100,000 years is such a vast quantity of time that it defies our imaginations. I'm not sure we even know how to push our ethical antenna out 100,000 years, but we're almost never asked to. I mean, when big climate people talk, they tend these days to talk about, you know, the end of this century. I mean, less than 100, you're talking 100,000. Begin to walk us into the picture that you see unfolding. When you think in those grand terms, do the big debates we're having over, you know, temperatures, warmest year or warmest decade and all that stuff now that we're talking about so much right now, do those just disappear? Are those just blips that will be somewhere in the distant past and inconsequential? Or what do you see unfolding, Kurt?
Well, it's not easy to think on these large timescales. And part of it's just the sheer numbers involved, like most of us don't have a daily working familiarity with things like millions and billions and such. And even for me as a geoscientist, it's sometimes hard for me to grasp it on the gut level, what these long timescales mean. But it's really important. And maybe what helps is sort of a visual description of a chart that I saw of this long-term future in some of the peer-reviewed literature that's been coming out in recent years that basically got me to write the book. Well, it was a graph of the carbon dioxide and the warming that we're producing now. Both are going up, and so that's the global warming and all that we're talking about. But if you take the entire 100,000-year block of time and put it on one chart, what you find is this global warming that we're in now is just the brief opening stage on that whole story. It goes up and reaches a peak sometime within the next couple of centuries where the maximum CO2 and the maximum warming is. Then it turns around suddenly and starts to drop again. And the image reminded me of a ski jump like you see in the Olympics, mm-hmm. where people go up this steep ladder. And that's the warming we're on. And then you get to this peak at the top where you turn around, what I call a climate whiplash, where what was once warming has suddenly become cooling. And it cools pretty rapidly. So it goes up in a spike, comes down kind of steeply in a cooling, but then curves and spreads out and comes down really, really slowly after that and stretches out to 100,000 years at least, which is long enough to interfere with ice ages. And to me, the most amazing thing was, look at that spike. What is that going to be like?
I mean, I'm looking at that chart right now, and I'm trying to get my head around what this means, really. I mean, clearly, one thing it means is global temperatures going way up extremely rapidly, as you say, for the next couple hundred years, at least on this chart. To something looks sort of unimaginable warmth. But then turning around, as you say, almost plummeting straight back down, not coming down as far as we are, not coming down to as cool as where we are now anywhere on this chart, which is going out 100,000 years. So I don't know. You could look at it and say, wow, this next couple hundred years looks like a terrible frying pan. But after that, maybe it's okay. Is that a reasonable way to look at this? I have no idea.
Well, it's one of the interesting things about this, just from a purely nerdy scientific perspective, is this is an uncharted territory for us. And so what I've tried to do is just sketch out the basic outlines and present this, do a little exploring of questions like we're doing right now, and then encourage everybody to start thinking on this, because I think it'll take all of our brains to wrap around it. But I certainly wouldn't call it okay. One of the things I took away from seeing that chart the first time was we're very concerned with good reason about the global warming going on. But what I realized was that it's not just the warming itself that's the problem. It's temperature change of any kind is disruptive, maybe in different ways, in different times and places. So the long picture of this is actually going to be the cooling off recovery, in which the way we've been adapting in the near term will have to reverse and accommodate, you know, increasing ice cover and shrinking sea levels and things like that as well.
What do you lose in that spike of the next 100, 200 years right in front of us, you know, that you then describe as us recovering from later? What gets lost in that incredible spike?
Well, as you alluded to earlier on, I make the case that humankind, although suffering is probably going to be involved, I don't think our species itself is going to be lost in this kind of thing, because from my historical perspective, looking at ice ages and terrible droughts of the past, people pulled through even with Stone Age technology. And some parts of the world are likely to kind of maybe actually become more habitable. So I think humankind is going to be here. It's other species I'm mostly worried about. And that peak is when we're going to lose most of them.
And we're going to talk about that when we come back. Just what gets lost in this big spike right at the beginning of a huge expanse of time we're talking about today with Kurt Steger, paleoclimatologist, author of Deep Future. Listeners, you can join us. Do you think we, life on Earth, will be around another 100,000 years? Do the quakes and tsunamis and crazy weather make you wonder, can you picture that our cars and coal plants today may shape Earth's climate 50,000 years from now? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the deep future of life and climate on this planet with paleoclimatologist Kurt Steger. His new book is Deep Future, the Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. And I want to look at what you're anticipating here, but let me just ask you first, Kurt, when you get to this scale of time, I'm honestly not sure how ethics work here. I mean, if you go, you know, back to sort of the earliest recorded history, I don't know, ancient Greece and Pericles and all that, that's only 5,000 years ago. You're talking about 100,000 years. Politicians talk about our obligation to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. You're into times so distant that it's hard to even empathize with what's out there. As a paleoclimatologist, do you feel, tangibly an ethical obligation to life 100,000 years from now?
Well, it's tough, of course. You know, if you don't know people, it's hard to empathize all the way with them. But I liken this idea to the emotional jolt I got when I saw the first photos of the Earth from space. And it just sort of seeing that we're floating in this little habitable bubble in deep space sort of gives you this gut level sense of who we are and our place in the universe. And to me, seeing that chart and realizing that it's not just science fiction, but science fact, that we can now look that far into the deep future as we could into deep space like that, to me, it transforms our sense of our place in history. And what's the most amazing thing is the choice of how long that future lasts, whether we do 100,000 years of impact or 500,000 years of impact, and how intense it is going to be decided by people that are alive right now in the world.
How can our cars and boats and coal plants and, I mean, as big as they are, they still seem puny in the face of 100,000 years or 500,000 years, how can they affect the climate of the planet for that long, Kurt?
Well, it's basically comes down to asking this simple question that sort of would come naturally if you think of the Earth being a finite bubble floating in space. When we release these greenhouse gases, they don't just kind of go away in a permanent sense, like out into space or something. They're stuck here on the planet, and they have to go somewhere once we release them. And so they do build up. And basically, the origin of this kind of research that people are doing now is they're just asking, where does the carbon go when it leaves our tailpipes and smokestacks? So any individual car or smokestack is not what matters. It's the collective whole over time. And basically, there are only two places for this to go. One is to dissolve in the ocean, like any gas will do. Most mm-hmm. of the planet's covered with water. So that's where the kind of steep cooling recovery is going to be happening from in the next several thousand years. The ocean is going to soak a lot of this up. But it can only take so much. So the rest of the CO2 is basically marooned on the air. And it'll float around until it eventually collides with rocks and soils and has chemical reactions that take it out. And then that will wash into the oceans, sort of neutralize them. It's like giving them an antacid pill so they can mm-hmm. eat a little more. And that takes so long that it makes that long, slow tail off. One of the main researchers is David Archer. He's at the University of Chicago. He calls this the long tail of the CO2 curve, where the rocks are slowly absorbing it.
And can it really be? I mean, decisions that we're making now or in the next 10, 20, 30 years could affect 50 or 100,000 or more years of Earth climate then?
Absolutely. That's the stunning thing about it is we are incredibly important. It's basically what I do is just sort of look at two possible scenarios we could take from here on out. And one is to switch as quickly as we can away from fossil fuels. If we do that, we've already affected things for 100,000 years, long enough to stop the next ice age. But if we just ignore that then and we just continue as we've been and burn up all of our coal and other fossil fuels, mm-hmm. that will be enough to make 5 or 10 times more intense a warming peak and stretch that long tail out, not just 100,000 years, but 500,000 years into the future.
Can we
I'm sorry.
A million years. That's a pretty good chunk of time. Can we look at that spike itself? Would you say we are fueling up right now with our CO2 exhaust and emissions? What are the changes we're likely to see on land, on sea, on the place where they meet in this that spike that's sitting in front of us now?
Well, I tried to tease that out, so I zeroed in just on that whiplash time scale is what I've been calling it. It's all being determined by how much carbon dioxide we release now. So it's sort of the basic principle of what goes up must come down, let's say. So our emissions are eventually going to level off either because we choose to do it soon or we have to do it later. When that spike of CO2 goes up, the amount in the air will also peak and then begin to recover. And then after a slight delay, then the temperature will reach a maximum too because of all the heat trapping gases. But then as the gases drop, so will the temperature. And then eventually the sea level will have to come around as well when it cools enough. But each of these peaks is a separate thing, like a separate wave hitting us one after another. And in that confusing whiplash time, temperatures at one point will be starting to fall, but we'll still have rising sea levels. So it's very interesting and complex and confusing.
What about changes in coastline, global species, the oceans during that spike in temperature?
Right. Well, the temperatures are eventually going to reverse and come back down. So those will move back and forth. The acidity of the oceans that's going to be resulting from all this CO2 is going to eventually reverse. And the sea level will be coming up and then it will go back out like it always has in history. The one thing that's irreversible, though, is the loss of the species. As the temperatures changed in the past, things could pretty much move freely and go north or south and find whatever habitat they needed to live in. Now, because humans are in the picture in this Anthropocene epoch, basically, you could say we're in the way. we're limiting their migration with our cities and roads and farms and such. So that free migration is often no longer possible. And so the loss of the species, especially in the next few centuries, is going to be the most long-term change of all of this.
Not to mention the topography, coastline, where agriculture is possible. You're talking about sort of yacht clubs at the North Pole and the farm, you know, big farms on Greenland, which is under all that ice now.
Yeah, it's if you talk about what are the conditions on the ground, I sort of looked around at some of the places that you could make some reasonable speculations about. And some places will be less hospitable, partly because they're warmer and maybe they depended on ice, like when you lose mountain glaciers in Peru or the Himalayas, let's say, that are a source of water. Or if you're in the American Southwest or Southern Africa, where the rain belts are expected to move away and parch the place. But other areas will likely get wetter or arguably more hospitable. Like I use Greenland as an example and said, well, we hear a lot about the ice going away, and that's a shocking development. But, you know, what's under the ice? And when it's revealed, what will that mean for people living in Greenland? And, of course, there are minerals in those rocks under the ice, and you can do agriculture with an open Arctic Ocean without the ice on it. There's probably going to be a fishery up there and trade. So it's just an interesting, complicated mix of responses where there'll be a mix of winners and losers. And I'm not sure how it's going to balance out, if it's more winners or losers.
When you speak to somebody who works in this kind of period of time, you're accustomed to species coming and going, mastodons and all the rest. When you're talking about 65 million years, it would be not too hard to listen to you, and it can sound like, you know, a sort of some American conservatives who say, look, let's get over it. The Earth changes. There will be winners and there will be losers, as you say. As you say, hard to know if it's more winners or losers. Do you have that attitude about it?
No, I don't. And that's a risk I take in this book. I've tried to walk the middle line and be as factual as I could without going into the values of it and just sort of say, I hope we can all look at this, move on from this log jam about the, you know, is global warming happening, and use all of our input to really look at the big picture. My personal bias is, for me, because we're involved and these changes are the result of conscious decisions, there are ethics involved. And I definitely don't feel the same about losing species because of our air pollution the same way as I would about an ice age taking them out.
Kurt Steiger is with us. His new book is Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. And let's begin to bring our listeners in. Kurt, stand by there in Toronto. We've got a call from Ontario. Richard is on the line. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, gentlemen, Tom and Dr. Steiger. I'm actually listening on North Country Public Radio.
Fantastic.
So a lot. While I was listening just for the last moment or two, I had this idea of a fantasy panel discussion with you and E.O. Wilson and Jared Diamond discussing sort of the big picture of things. But
maybe we'll put it together, Roy.
I'd love that.
And I will drive down to Boston, okay, especially to be there.
Okay.
The reason I actually called was a comment when you had made the comment about humans will endure, but it's the other species that will collapse. And of course, both E.O. Wilson speak to this, and I guess Jared Diamond, particularly in collapse, that's more sociological, of course. But my question then is, what is the relationship between collapsing species upon which we humans are dependent and our own viability to continue to exist? If all those other species, for pharmaceuticals and whatnot, are no longer there. How do you see that having an impact on our own ability to continue to survive?
It's a great question. Thank you so much, Richard. Kurt?
Yeah, I'd say that's a very serious problem. And I think the species loss to ocean acidification from the buildup of the CO2 is the most likely to have those kinds of effects, because we eat so much of the things that live in the oceans like that. So it's tough t- tough to say what it would all mean.
You're saying big acidification with what consequence for species in the oceans, for example, Kurt?
Yeah, like when the ocean acidifies, anything that has a shell made out of anything like limestone, whether it's shellfish or crabs or shrimp or even corals, which make habitats for other species to live in, it's already happening, actually. It's being measured that it's harder for them to make their shells and maintain them, and eventually they may actually dissolve. So those are the kinds of things that I would be most worried about in human terms. But I do also have to say that I'm mainly talking about sheer survival of the entire species here.
When you say humans will endure, you certainly don't mean all of our great-grandchildren or great-great. I mean, it means the species will endure, but who knows what fraction of it that means?
That's right. And people have lived from polar regions to the burning deserts of the tropics with almost no technology. So the reason I'm focusing on that and not trying to belittle the suffering or the need to adapt and things like that is a lot of folks don't believe we're going to be here in 100,000 years. And so therefore, why should we care about all this? So that's why I do come back to the idea that we will endure, although it may be a tough road.
And when you say we, though, it certainly is, again, it doesn't mean that you're talking about a lot of suffering along that path, but a presumption on your part that some number of human beings, the species, will hang in there.
Absolutely, yes. I don't want to belittle that, but I use that to show that it really does matter that we make these decisions because people are going to have to live through what we decide now.
Let's get a call from Chris in Waltham, Massachusetts. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I was in Iceland in 2004, shortly after the International Convention on Climate Change occurred there. You were probably at that yourself.
And, oh, I missed it, but it was...
Okay.
What did you hear there, Chris?
Well, I spoke with relatives and friends while I was there about the subject, since it had been discussed very much in the news during the conference. And they all agreed that the climate change was going on. They could see it in different species, and in the melting of the glaciers. Glaciers cover about a quarter of the country, and they're melting quite rapidly. And they all agreed that it was a terrible thing. Iceland may become more habitable in the eyes of Americans and Europeans, but they saw it as a disaster in the making for their own selves.
I mean, it's that connection to all the life around us now, Kurt, that seems to me in your description to be on the line here. We may go on, but in circumstances so changed. I mean, you described the sort of climate we've recently been through, recent in your terms, as sort of Club Med here after times when the Earth has been, you know, wretchedly hot and much more often wretchedly cold. We've been in a sweet spot, and that sweet spot seems to be what we are in the process of eating away at.
Yeah, that's right, because I'd like to, you know, sort of move on from having made my point that people are going to be here and having made it only to show you that it really does matter to humans and then come back to how we're talking here. These changes are happening before our eyes right now, and this long-term view of the future shows that although we can't avoid some kind of change now that we've gotten the ball rolling, we can avoid the most severe changes, and we know what they will be like because now we can see the charts of what the carbon dioxide and the temperatures are going to do. So one of the things that convinced me, in addition to the more esoteric studies about climate change, is I've been seeing the changes where I live in the Adirondacks around Paul Smith's College. You can see there's less ice duration on the lakes around there. And more often than not, lakes like Lake Champlain don't even freeze over completely in the winter anymore. So different parts of the world, people are observing this happen over the course of their daily lives.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the deep future of life and climate on this planet with paleoclimatologist Kurt Steiger. His new book is Deep Future, the Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Let's get a call right here from Harrisonburg, Virginia. And Mike. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Kurt. This is your old fishing buddy. What's going
hey,
on,
Mike.
Man?
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, sure. My question is, and I had another one as I was waiting, but my first question is, you know my kids, and I'm kind of wondering what they'll see in their lifetime as far as the effect of the greenhouse gases and other things on our environment, species, and that sort of thing. And then as I heard you talk about acidity rising in the ocean, I'm wondering what the fresh water that enters the ocean will do to the salinity of the ocean and possibly effects on the Gulf Stream and that sort of deal. So I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Thank you, fishing sure. buddy. Mike, what do you say, Kurt? Mike's got kids 9 and 10. He's thinking about their lifetimes.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a lot hotter down in Virginia in the summer, so I hope they'll come visit me up in the Adirondacks more often. So that's pretty obvious it's going to be getting hotter down there. I'm not sure the precip predictions there, but so you'll see vegetation changes. The kinds of woods growing around Harrisonburg where you all are used to be up in the Adirondacks before the last ice age when we had that relatively mild warming between the ice ages. So basically, if they move up to the Adirondacks or their grandkids do, then it will feel like where you're living now. As far as the fresh water going in and affecting the Gulf Stream, that is a concern. The latest research that I've been able to see suggests that compared to giant floods going into the North Atlantic in the distant past at the end of the last ice age, that was severe enough to make major climate changes by changing the ocean currents and such. And we've already got some of that going on from the melting in Greenland, but there's not so much ice left up there to really shut things down. So most models that I've seen reports from suggest, yes, we may get some effects, but they're going to be swamped out by this carbon dioxide effect.
We've got a listener in Vermont who says, and there's some echo of this in the first part of this in your book. He says, we as a species have proven we are incapable of self-limiting our population, and we have no predators. It goes on, I'm glad I won't be around in 100,000 years to see what life is like for people, flora, and fauna on this planet. He says, I'm glad I won't be around in 100 years, for that matter. Now, you can't tell from core samples what life thinks about its circumstances at any given strata of millions of years, I guess. But what about that notion of a listener says he's glad he won't be around even in 100 years, certainly not in 100,000. You think in these terms. What about that, Kurt?
Yeah. Well, it's a tough call. My personal guess is that people that are born into the far future will love the world that they're born into. It'll seem normal to them. I mean, I make the point in the book, since we're in this Anthropocene epoch, people like me already know that the world we live in is hugely changed by things we've been doing for the last thousands of years. There are invasive species everywhere. In North America, where I'm living, there should be mammoths and mastodons running around in the woods. So if I lived back in, the ice age when mammoths were normal, I would be maybe sad not to have them around now. And now, although I think it's kind of a shame, I'm not all that depressed about it. So I probably couldn't argue with the caller saying they might not want to be around. But my guess is people in the future will get used to the new face of the world. And that sort of brings me back to that point of, when we go through the whiplash and go into the cooling, those kinds of changes will be just as upsetting, too. When the Northern Ocean starts to freeze over again, for example, people will be horrified at the thought of having a northern ice cap over what they're used to seeing as open ocean.
You mean maybe, 10,000 years from now or more?
Yeah. I mean, if people have a long-term view then, by that time, if we're talking thousands of years in the future here, of the Arctic Ocean having no ice on it in the summer and maybe even in the winter, there will be new ecosystems and cultures adapting to that new setting so that when the cooling happens, they're going to be put at risk as the ocean starts to freeze over again. And they'll be horrified about the global cooling.
Horrified that maybe polar bears reappearing. who knows? Possibly, maybe. You know, this is just incredible. At a certain point, talking with somebody who thinks in your expanses of time gets really slippery and confusing. I mean,
it's not just you. It's me, too.
Yeah, I want to bring a big green voice in here to add to the mixture of everything you're sharing with us today. Kurt, please stand by. Bill McKibben joins us from Middlebury, Vermont, environmentalist and author of Earth with Two A's, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, most recently co-founder of 350.org, an environmental group working to contain CO2, help solve the climate crisis. He's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont. Bill McKibben, welcome back to One Point. Thanks for being here.
Tom, good to be with you as always. And hey, Kurt, good to be with you too.
So it's great to have you guys together. And I see here, Bill, you've blurbed Kurt's new book, Deep Future, very nicely. But what are you thinking as here this guy who thinks in chunks of, 50 or 100,000 years at a time is talking about the day? I mean, here you are ringing all kinds of alarm bells about the melting polar cap. And he's saying, well, people sort of love the world they're born into whenever it is. And sometime out there, 10,000 years or I don't know what, people may be upset that the North Pole is freezing again.
What does it say,
Bill?
I think you're almost putting words in Kurt's mouth.
Oh, I really don't think so. I've written them all down.
I think what he was saying earlier is key, that the next 30 years is the moment when we decide how much of this whiplash we're going to see in the years ahead, in the epochs ahead. You were talking earlier about sort of how hard it is to imagine that humans could actually do this, and it is hard to imagine. You're absolutely right. But if you think about it, I mean, just look at the fairly recent past. 200 years ago, the level of carbon in the atmosphere was 275 parts per million. It had been that way all through the Holocene. Then we learned this new trick, burning coal and gas and oil. And in essence, we took millions and millions and millions of years of biological history, filed away there in oil wells and coal mines, and tossed it all up in the atmosphere at once. That 275 has gone now to 390, and as a result, we're already seeing changes on the scale that Kurt's talking about. I mean, today, the new data shows that we enter the Arctic ice melt season this year with the lowest amount of ice we've ever recorded. It looks quite possible that we'll have an ice-free Arctic within the decade. These changes are already enormous. And what we do in the next, Kurt, you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's what we do in the next 10, 20, 30 years that really decides what happens 10,000, 20,000 years down the pike.
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I could jump in here, Bill was right. Thanks for saving me on that. What I was trying to convey to the caller there about being concerned about watching the North refreeze and all, I do think people will be used to the world that they're born into. So these people in the future will not see the refreezing of the Arctic as a great thing. Oh, it's going back to normal. They will see it as a crisis. And so my point is that the effects we're having on future generations could very well be mostly negative, even in reverse, for tens of thousands of years.
This just turns out to be this incredible geological hinge. And the question is, can we keep that most of what's left of that coal and oil and gas in the ground? And ultimately, that's a political question. 2 days ago, the president announced that they were opening up 750 million tons worth of coal in Wyoming under federal land, most of which will end up in China fueling their power plants if we don't keep it in the ground. That's the kind of unbelievably tragic and short-sighted mistake that people make when they don't pay attention to the kind of conversation that you guys have been having today. Tom, you're so right to have Kurt on because it underscores that this is not one on a kind of endless list of problems that we're always dealing with, you know, the drug crisis or the war and whatever. This is the only geological scale crisis that we've ever come up against. But because it plays out over tens of thousands of years, that doesn't mean that that's... The politically relevant time frame is tens of years, not tens of thousands. All of that is just the aftermath, the denouement. Mm. We're in the middle of the drama right now.
But, you know, Bill, the reason I asked you on, not just because you blurbed the book, but I found it interesting in part because there is this tension about how we look at this planet over time. And it is not at all difficult to tune into conservative talk radio where a kind of version of what Kurt is saying is deployed as grounds for opposition to taking action on climate. People say, look, the Earth has always warmed and it's always cooled. We've had boiling ages and ice ages, and we will again. Kurt says, you know, there's going to be winners and losers, maybe more winners than losers, depending how you look at it. People get used to what they're born into. This perspective I have heard used repeatedly over time to push back against exactly the kind of steps that you advocate for, Bill.
I don't think Kurt's saying, and I don't think really there's any scientist at the moment saying that there are going to be more winners than losers from the kind of rapid climate change we're engaged in. We think now that virtually every place, I mean, we used to say 10 or 15 years ago, maybe Russia will be a winner because it'll have better grain growing. Well, mm-hmm. after what we saw last summer with this absolutely record heat wave that knocked Russian agriculture for a loop and as a result increased grain prices around the world 70% or so, that's, you know, already there are lots and lots of people not getting enough for dinner because of the changes that we're making to the climate of this one planet that we've got. I think that that there are people who go on right-wing talk radio and say that, but the reason they say it is pretty clear. The financial power of the fossil fuel industry that would like to keep its windfall profits going for another decade or two without the slightest concern for the things that Kurt's talking about, the next 50, 100, 200,000 years of life on this planet, that's what's going on. And if we're fool enough, I mean, at some level, this is like a final exam for human beings, human civilizations. Can we take these warnings that science is giving us and do something with them in the time that we have? Or are we just going to keep blindly going, doing what we're doing, as if the scientists haven't warned us? And, you know, at the moment, clearly that's the direction we're going in. If President Obama is opening up, you know, Wyoming to full-on coal mining, then, you know, our chances at the moment can't be rated as all that good. But it's why we do things like 350.org, try to build these big global campaigns, of which Kurt's been a real help, try to slow this down.
Kurt Stigler, let me put that to you, though. Those, and you must have heard it yourself, who are opposed to, you know, cutting back on fossil fuel consumption and say, and I've heard it again and again, we have had hot ages and cold ages, ice ages and boiling ages on this planet. We will again. They might even cite your book and say, you know, read Kurt Steger. He says so. What do you say to that perspective, Kurt, that says, chill out, human beings have been through this before, we'll go through it all again, there's cycles here?
Yeah, I've tried not to sound like that, and basically was trying to present facts. And some climate skeptics that I met just on the street, regular folks, do have sincere questions. But to me, I actually have hope that we're going to be able to pull this off if we really pay attention to it. Because even if you don't believe that we're affecting the climate, there are plenty of good reasons to switch from the fossil fuels. The, you know, the most obvious one is we're starting to run out of the cheap ones. And when that economic crisis hits us, it's going to hurt everybody. So even if you don't believe the climatic effects, like basically all scientists do, I think we can all get behind the push to finding alternative energy.
So here we are. It's 2011. You're looking 100,000 years out. And right at the beginning in our lifetimes and just after is this huge spike in temperature that you show on the chart that so turned you around, Kurt. How much, if we act and act very decisively, how much could we knock that spike down, to diminish it, its impact and the impact of all that follows from that over eons here, if we jump in with both feet right away, Kurt? How much could we pull back on that trend?
Well, the mainstream science says there's such a thing as climate commitment, that if we instantly, overnight, magically stopped releasing all the CO2, just the backlog of responses will still warm us somewhat. So I'd say in the best case scenario, we're going to probably get the relatively moderate scenario that will make us end up looking like the warm spell between the last two ice ages.
And so, do the poles survive that, the ice caps, I should say?
It'll be touch and go. It looks like the Arctic Ocean was mostly ice-free during summer at that time, but polar bears as a species survived that. So it'll be really close if we pull back on the brakes right now, but I think we can do it.
Bill McKibben, we've just got half a minute. It's the Anthropocene, the age of humans. How do you see the signature we're going to leave on the beginning of that age, Bill?
This is entirely up to us, and it is entirely up to what we do in the next 10 or 20 years. Here's the horrible thing. Because of the lag times that Kurt describes, the actions that we take have to be taken in advance of the worst effects being felt. It's a real test of how moral, how smart, and really just how human in the end we really are. We're finding out if the big brain was a good adaptation or not, and we'll see.
We've got it. It can imagine all kinds of things. The charts are being drawn. Bill McKibben, author of Earth, and co-founder of 350.org. Bill, thank you for joining us today.
Of course. Take care.
Kurt Steger, joining us today from Toronto, Canada, paleoclimatologist at Paul Smith's College in Paul Smith's, New York. You may have heard him on North Country Public Radio up there. His new book is Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Kurt, thank you for the glimpse into the way, way out there. We really enjoyed having you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, and hello to everybody in the beautiful Adirondacks.
May they stay so beautiful. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.